this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll dig a little deeper into the January issue of Our State Magazine, which features articles all about North Carolina's cozy season. And our first article is entitled, Curl Up with a Good Book. 8 Snug Spots to Curl Up with a Good Book. From mountain reading nooks to coastal shelves, discover inviting and sometimes unexpected winter sanctuaries for your next story. Up first is Asheville, Battery Park Book Exchange and Champagne Bar. In Asheville's historic Grove Arcade, Thomas and Donna Wright combined his love of literature with her love of champagne to create a cafe of literary decadence. Browse 2.5 stories of books with a beverage in hand, strolling over Persian rugs to Middle Earth, the not quite upstairs, the not quite downstairs level that houses a collection of art books. With its red walls adorned with oil paintings, velvet curtains, and jazz musicians playing several nights a week, guests can step into a genteel time, half hoping to bump shoulders with F. Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald. The Battery Park Book Exchange is located on Page Avenue, Suite 101, Asheville, North Carolina, and their website is batterypark.bookexchange.com. After browsing the shelves at Battery Park Book Exchange and Champagne Bar, guests can cozy up on leather couch with a glass of bubbly. Then there's the Highlander Mountain House in Highlands. Casting light on leather-bound books, a taxidermy pheasant, sheepskins, and hand-hewn ceiling beams, a wood fire burns faithfully year-round, the heartbeat of Highlander Mountain House. Flanked by well-worn leather chairs and facing a kiln-covered couch, the stone fireplace warms the living room of the storybook boutique hotel, offering a cozy respite for guests to pick up a tome or swap tales with fellow travelers. I want it to feel like a warm hug, a place where you can hole up by the fire, read a book, and escape your everyday life, says owner Jason Reams. Follow the narrative thread woven into the decor, artifacts of the Cherokee, the art of Southern Highlanders, and the legacy of Black Mountain College artists, and let their stories come alive. Highlander Mountain House is located at 270 Main Street, Highlands, North Carolina, and their website is highlandermountainhouse.com. Moving to Waynesville and Wall Street Books. Lying at the foot of Miss Virginia, Wall Street Books' signature green couch, naps Pippin, the curly-coated bookstore dog. There's a good chance his tail is pointing to the Harry Potter reading nook. Here, fans can don the sorting hat before venturing among the underground bookshop's shelves while wrought iron sconces on posts light the way like subterranean light street lamps. I always dreamed about having a bookstore, says owner Greg Owens, who acquired the 30-year-old business a decade ago, expanding it with book clubs and community events. Chess and checkers await under the glowing paper lanterns and antique chairs, floral for romance, leather for westerns, encourage thumbing and skimming. Well-behaved dogs, naturally, are welcomed. And Wall Street Books is located at 163 Wall Street, Waynesville. And their website is wallstreetbooksnc.com. And turning to Durham, there's Ruby Fruit at Queenie's. Tucked in the back corner of Queenie's Bar and Restaurant, Ruby Fruit, part bookshop, part reading room, holds co-owner Michelle Vanderwalker's carefully curated section of titles, which mingle with childhood mementos and comforting curios. I love the idea of a casual space to get together, says Vanderwalker, whose vision for Queenie's was born from the community spirit she felt while hosting potlucks at her home. Translating this to the restaurant, she kept books and toys on hand for those moments of needing to slip away from the gathering. Curl up on the window seat under the watchful eye of Vanderwalker's grandfather's stuffed lion on the shelf above, or snag a book to read at the bar, burger in hand. If you can't put it down, just add it to your tab. Ruby Fruit at Queenie's is located at 321 East Chapel Hill Street, Suite 100 in Durham. And their website is queeniesdurham.com. In Black Mountain, it's Town Hardware and General Stores Book Nook. Overlooking rows of housewares and tubs of timeless candy, the Town Hardware and General Stores Book Nook offers a literary hideaway for the homesteader, regional history seeker, and curious child. While the hardware store has been a community fixture since 1928, owners Beth and Peter Balhassan saw potential for the unused loft after purchasing the business in 2013. There was a little gem just waiting to be unearthed, Beth says. Visitors can sit in the rocker underneath the warmth of a sunburst window and flip through books on everything from North Carolina history to outdoor living. You want children to be unplugged, says Beth, who dedicates much of the nook to children's books. After reading, sneak downstairs for a soda or nostalgic knick-knack, and maybe grab a ball-peen hammer while you're at it. Town Hardware and General Store Book Nook is located at 103 West State Street in Black Mountain, North Carolina, and their website is townhardwaregeneralstore.com. Moving to Banner Elk Book Exchange. Emerging from a community's desire to save its town's epicenter from development, the Banner Elk Book Exchange has been the hub of the Cultural Arts Center at the historic Banner Elk School since its opening in 2015. Operating with a bring a book, take a book policy, the exchange honors the scholastic tradition of the 1939 WPA-built stone building in which it resides. It's like a gathering place, a spot for people to come and check on their neighbors, says Donna Dix, committee member and former librarian at the school. Beyond books, the Explorer's Room houses maps, microscopes, and natural treasures for young learners to tinker with, while a jigsaw puzzle is under construction at all times. Banner Elk Book Exchange is located at 185 Azalea Circle, Banner Elk, and their website is BannerElkBookExchange.com. Going to the other side of the state, Old Books on Front Street in Wilmington. Gwynifar Roller remembers her parents bringing flashlights to Mr. Daughtry's bookstore, which lacked electricity and remained open only during daylight, when she was a child. He wasn't a reader. He was there for people, says Roller, recalling how Mr. Daughtry shelved a Confederacy of Dunces in the store's Civil War section. Chosen to be his successor, Roller now manages the store's 2 miles of shelving, much of it made from recycled movie sets. Like Mr. Daughtry, Roller shows up every day for whomever might walk through the door. The store has seen 5 engagements, 2 funerals, a baptism, and a baby shower. In the shop's many nooks and crannies live a piano named Estelle, a Venda poem machine, and a plenty of spaces to hunker down with a comforting classic. Old Books on Front Street is located at 249 North Front Street, Wilmington, and their website is oldbooksonfrontstreet.com. Staying on the eastern side of the state, Core Sound Waterfowl Museum's Robert Turnage Monk Library on Harker's Island. Perched on the shelves of the Robert Turnage Monk Library, decoys stand guard over books anchored in the culture of eastern North Carolina, centuries of Core Sound's waterfowl heritage. In a room fashioned after old hunting clubs, dark wood and comfy upholstered chairs are a refuge for diving into the area's natural and maritime history. Literature here is strictly regional. Birds, boat building, fishing, and shipwrecks. We educate people now in lots of different ways, said Executive Director Karen Willis Amspacher. But there's still no substitute for an old-fashioned book with real paper pages. She often finds visitors dozing with the ducks as they explore the sounds storied past, reading themselves to sleep, adrift in seafaring dreams. And the library is located at 1785 Island Road on Harker's Island, and their website is coresound.com. Now, if you visit one of those bookshops, you might need something to read. So we've got an idea of six timeless winter reads for you. Travel back to historic events and find warmth in the words and faraway worlds dreamt of by these North Carolina authors. The first one is The Road to Bittersweet by Donna Everhart. Recommended by Dawn Miller, owner of Pelican Bookstore in Sunset Beach, this mountain read takes place in the 1940s. The story, told from the perspective of 14-year-old Wallace Ann, follows a family after a Tuskegee River flood forced them to flee their generational home in Appalachia. Despite its historical setting, the novel relays the timeless tale of how tragedy often leads resilient Southern families to new beginnings. Next up is The Winter People by John Ehle, E-H-L-E. Not sure how to pronounce that. I apologize if I butchered that. On a chilly winter night during the Great Depression, single mother Collie Wright spots trespassers trekking through the woods near her 150-year-old North Carolina mountain cabin. After a hospitable one-night invitation turns into a courtship, the father of her infant returns ready to fight. First published in 1982, the story was also made into a film in 1989. It's a classic and it's beloved, says Sarah Ogletree, co-owner of Plot Hound Books in Burnsville. Plot Hound Tales, Legendary People and Places Behind the Breed by Bob Plott. There's no better person to learn about our state dog from than a descendant of the canine's first breeder. Since their 1750s emergence in western North Carolina, plot hounds have become integral in traditional bear and wild boar hunts. Today, most hunts in the western part of the state take place in Pisgah and Nantahala National Forest during cooler seasons. This hound history lesson is best curled up with your favorite pup. The Caretaker by Ron Rash. In 1951, Jacob Hampton, a native of Blowing Rock, is drafted to fight in the Korean War. After his parents refuse to care for his wife, Jacob turns to Blackburn Gant, the town cemetery's caretaker. Shunned because of a physical deformity, Blackburn accepts the responsibility as a favor to his only friend. After bracing frigid winters on the battlefield, Jacob returns to discover that life in rural Appalachia can be even more bone-chilling. Rash has a way of including the heritage, the culture, and history of North Carolina in his books that resonates with readers, Miller says. The Kudzu Queen by Mimi Herman. Rooted in the history of the kudzu craze of the 1930s and 40s, this story reveals the complicated past of the vine that invaded the South. When James T. Cullowhee arrives in North Carolina to promote a miracle plant, Mattie Lee Watson, 15, unveils the dark sides of both James and kudzu. The main character reminds me a lot of Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird, says Pete Mock, lead buyer for McIntyre's books in Pittsboro of Mattie Lee. You want to read about her. The Correspondent by Virginia Evans. Sybil Van Antwerp, 73, has spent most of her life writing to everyone, drafting records of her own history. As she reminisces on the letters she's composed to prominent figures from her earlier decades, she receives unexpected correspondence from someone she knew during a painful period in her past. In an attempt at closure, Sybil realizes it's time for her long-withheld words to be read. And here's a little sub-article. It's called One for the History Books. The story behind the 79-year-old Historical Book Club of North Carolina is nearly as captivating as the novels they praise. There have been several memorable moments since a group of avid female readers founded the Historical Book Club of North Carolina in Greensboro in 1947. Perhaps none competes with the time Governor Luther Hodges, on behalf of the club, presented a statuette of Sir Walter Raleigh to Queen Elizabeth II when she visited the United States in 1957. Martha Hodges, the governor's wife, was a club member and had the idea of gifting the statuette to Her Majesty, who is said to have remarked, "How lovely." Nearly 80 years after it was founded, the HBCNC has grown to more than 200 members. The club was created to keep readers informed on new works of history, but today its programs primarily feature fiction and occasionally other genre like nonfiction, drama, and poetry. The HBCNC may never get to present another gift to another monarch. Still, each of its meetings leaves an impression. Kimberly Heckman, chair of the club's Sir Walter Raleigh Award for Fiction, chosen by judges from works submitted by North Carolina authors, was particularly wowed by the talk that Chatham County writer Marjorie Hudson gave. Hudson won the award in 2023 for her book Indigo Field, which explores racial tension in the South. Her talk showed the redemptive spirit in each of us and highlighted the need for community in all of its different facets, Heckman says. In addition to the annual speech from the recipient of the Sir Walter Raleigh Award, the group hosts a town meeting on books initiated in 1948 featuring a notable writer. "These authors are all so delightful," President Louise Courts says, "and it's interesting to hear about their writing process and how they get their ideas." For Heckman and Courts, each meeting is yet another memorable moment. Next, we'll turn to one of our regular columns entitled Hidden History, uncovering forgotten artifacts and delving into dusty archives to explore the little-known stories of our state. This article is entitled Making Tracks. A long-forgotten series of recordings made in Asheville in 1925 puts a new spin on the beginnings of country music. Heat and pressure. When applied in the right amounts and under the right conditions, these forces create diamonds. And that's exactly what recording director and music impresario Ralph Peer was hoping to mine in a small room on the rooftop of the George Vanderbilt Hotel in Asheville in August of 1925. The heat came from late summer in the South. The pressure? Peer put that on himself. His New York bosses at OK Records had invested in this trip in the heart of the Appalachian Mountains to record, quote, old-time music. His first recording trip to Atlanta in 1923 had produced what one might call a diamond in the rough, a record featuring Fiddlin' John Carson that included the old little log cabin in the lane backed by the old hen cackled and the rooster's gonna crow. Not expecting much from the endeavor, OK is said to have ordered just 500 to 1,000 copies of the record, yet it was an immediate hit, eventually selling hundreds of thousands of copies. Perhaps at least one of the songs from the Asheville sessions would show the same flash of brilliance. Another of the artists Peer had recorded during those Atlanta sessions was Buncombe County's Bascom Lamar Lunsford, an attorney, performer, and collector of Appalachian songs. Lunsford was well acquainted with the music talent in the western North Carolina, and some historians believe he influenced Peer to choose Asheville for the producer's second foray into the South. On August 17th, the Asheville Times ran a short article inviting musicians to apply for a recording slot. Lunsford was immediately proved right. The article garnered more than 300 responses. Peer whittled the number down to about 20 performers and ensembles, and August 25th, recording began. Whether any of the 50-plus tracks that were recorded would be a hit is still unknown, but one thing was certain. History was being made. Peer's equipment captured the first music ever recorded in North Carolina and the first commercial recordings made in Appalachia. For years, Bristol, Tennessee has been touted as the birthplace of country music. The title stems from a landmark series of recordings that Peer conducted for a different recording company, Victor, 2 years after the Asheville sessions. It was in Bristol that Pierre heard the Carter family and Jimmy Rogers for the first time. The Bristol sessions and the arrival of those two artists on the music scene is often referred to as the, quote, Big Bang that launched country music. While it makes for a tidy origin story, the truth is more nuanced. In fact, the Asheville sessions and North Carolina's rich musical traditions helped forge one of the nation's most enduring and popular music genre. Yet Asheville's role in the birth of country music might well be forgotten if not for a music historian from the North, North London, that is. Tony Russell grew up in the 60s and 70s listening to rhythm and blues before hearing the seminal Anthology of American Folk Music. It was issued in 1952 and fell upon the world like a biblical revelation, he says. The collection included old-time blues, folk, and Cajun music. For Russell, the songs were an intoxicating stew of influences that simmered up from a singular place. They were all part of a complex vernacular tradition that was largely southern, largely rural, and small town. In the fall of 1971, the long-haired Londoner with the English accent touched down in North Carolina. It was still possible at that time to find people who'd made records in the 20s and 30s, Russell says. It was the fulfillment of a dream. It made me realize the music of the past was not something to go to a museum to find out about. It was in the memories of living people. Russell wrote about the musicians he met in a magazine he published called Old Time Music. Among his readers was a fiddle player named Wayne Martin, who retired as executive director of the North Carolina Arts Council in 2021. For more than a half century now, Martin has been delving into the world of old time music, trying to understand the tradition and what it says about our state. Old-time music was social music, he explains. It was played to cement bonds, to bring a community together. It was old-time music that helped Martin forge social bonds when he moved to Raleigh in the mid-60s. A friend with an interest in string band music had purchased a banjo. He suggested, "Why don't you play the fiddle?" So I got me a fiddle and began sawing away. Some of the music has its origins in Scots-Irish fiddle tunes, but there's much more to it. You can tell it's been developed over generations, Martin says. There's a lot that comes from Black and Native traditions. These were songs played on front porches that echoed across valleys and hollows on sultry summer nights. Songs that were passed from one generation to the next like peas and cornbread at a church picnic. Pierre's goal was to share those songs with the wider world, to etch them into wax discs that could be played anywhere and anytime with the right kind of newfangled equipment. Pierre is trying to create a commercial genre that people can profit from, Martin says. They're basically trying to get the word out to people who might want to take a chance on the idea of it becoming a livelihood. But back in 1978, Martin had never heard of the Asheville Sessions. He was surprised to learn about the pivotal recordings from an article published in Russell's magazine. It was really a significant event, Martin says. I asked myself, why isn't this more available to people to learn about and have access to? Last fall, he and other organizers had a chance to help remedy that shortcoming. At a centennial event held in Asheville, descendants of some of the 1925 musicians spoke on a panel. A concert at Thomas Wolfe Auditorium, right next door to the building where the Asheville sessions took place, brought songs from the 1925 sessions to life. And 28 of the original OK recordings made in Asheville were released on both CD and double LP for a new generation of old-time fans. The hothouse environment of the Asheville sessions was captured in the Asheville Times article on August 25, 1925. There's a lot of respiration and perspiration connected with the making of phonograph records. Pierre had hedged his bets for the session. In addition to a lineup of previously unrecorded acts, he'd recruited some of OK's established artists, including Lunsford, Henry Whittier, and Ernest B. Stoneman, figuring the sales from those artists would justify the cost. Almost half of the performers were from North Carolina. The songs included event ballads about natural and man-made tragedies, often with a religious or moral message in the end. Russell says, adding, "This is a vigorous tributary of the great river of country songs. They included the wreck on the old Southern Old 97, performed by Kelly Harrell, the fate of Santa Barbara, performed by Lunsford and his brother Blackwell. There were also components of blues and pre-blues, ragtime and minstrel songs. In short, the influence of black musicians is palpable. The minstrel traditions of the past are offensive, but they reflect an attachment by white musicians to the art that was being made and interpreted by black musicians." Martin points to Emmett Miller's Lovesick Blues as a recording from the sessions whose reverberations are still being felt today. Hank Williams covered it, and you see it performed by modern bands. The titles of many of the tunes leave no doubt as to the rural red dirt origins of the music. Harmonica player Jim Couch performed Dill Pickle and Turkey in the Straw. J.D. Weaver played Arkansas Traveler and Hog Drivers. Banjoist Wade Ward served up Fox Chase, and vocalist Ernest Stoneman delivered the Kickin' Mule. After 9 days of recording, Peer packed up his equipment, promising to return, but he never did. He left OK for Victor Records. 2 years later, he made his fateful recording trip to Bristol. OK released several of the songs from the Asheville sessions, but none of them turned out to be big hits. They were unpurchased. They were purchased, listened to, and ultimately ended up in yard sales and secondhand shops, where they were scooped up by a few knowing record collectors. In recent years, Russell, Martin, and others have helped bring attention to their significance. It's some of the earliest documentation that we have of this incredibly resilient community music-making tradition in Western North Carolina, Martin says. I know how much that meant to me and my own sense of worth to know that the place I'd lived had created these really remarkable works of art, and that's part of who I am. Peer had to wait until the Bristol sessions before discovering the gems he was looking for, the singing and playing of the Carter family, the yodeling of Jimmy Rogers. Yet there's no doubt that the Asheville sessions produced something just as valuable, proof, etched in wax, of a legacy that still sparkles. Oh, we got a few moments left here, so I'm going to turn to our quiz page in our state. And this is entitled Mic Check. North Carolina's broadcast voices, past and present, sound like home. From 1953 to 1977, Charlotte's WBTV aired the first weekday lifestyle show in color. Who was the host making homemaking tips that helped make it the nation's third most watched women's program in 1965? Choices are A, Julia Child, B, Betty Feaser, and C, Martha Stewart. If you guessed B, Betty Feaser, you would be correct. Western North Carolina, veteran Western North Carolina newscaster Tammy Watford, known for her Never Stop Learning segment, works for which Asheville TV station? A, WLOS, B, WASH, or C, WSOC. If you guessed A, WLOS, you would be correct. We've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. This session is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974, and they can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired and is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For questions or comments, call us at 919-832-5138.